Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
That's the question that's been asked for the last 40 years to justify wealth accumulation. What happens if the rich leave? Well, let them leave. You know, why aren't we asking, why can't poorer people afford to live in the city? Why can't professional people afford to live in the city? Why can't homeless people afford to live in the city? Aren't those more important questions?
That's the voice of tireless poverty rights activist Jean Swanson. On this week's show, we speak to Jean about her run for Vancouver City Council and her intention to bring a revolution to Vancouver City Hall. So stay tuned. On the phone, I have Jean Swanson. Jean Swanson's been a tireless advocate on the downtown east side, fighting for rights for the most marginalized community in Canada and fighting for rights for the working poor in Vancouver. On many different issues, she's received the Order of Canada. She's currently put her name on the ballot for Vancouver City Hall for council member, and I have her on the line. Thanks for joining me, Jean.
You're welcome.
Now, can you tell me what your main motivation for running for council would be at this point in your life?
There's a bunch of young folks that convinced me that we needed to kind of open up City Hall for folks who are working for social and environmental justice, and we needed to get out there and say what's really needed and push for it. And so I decided, well, okay, I'll give it a shot.
People would say in Vancouver, many people would say that Vancouver City Hall is run by Vision Vancouver, a very progressive green mayor, and there's a lot of council members who care about these issues. How would you respond that voice may be already there?
Yeah, I've been fighting Vision for 10 years, or 9 years, however long they've been in. I've been working at the Carnegie Community Action Project, and they've been gentrifying the downtown east side and pushing people out of their hotels onto the street. They've totally ruined Chinatown with 17-story condo towers and yuppified businesses on the ground level, replacing the historic Chinese community businesses. They've allowed housing prices to get completely out of sight with their supply, supply, supply mantra that is building some rental housing but hardly anyone can afford it. They've changed the definition of social housing, so only 5 or 6% of the social housing that they claim to have built is affordable for people who are on a welfare or pension income, and a lot of it is really, really expensive.
There's a lot there, but let me touch on the first thing. A lot of listeners right across the country will hear this, who are living in big cities, and they're not quite familiar with, you are because you're doing it every day, but they're not quite familiar with how the process of gentrification works. They see new developments and they get excited and say, oh, our city's improving. Look at these new buildings and investment. But can you kind of outline how gentrification works, especially for people who are renting or working class people?
So gentrification is a process where usually it involves the city upzoning, which means they say that developers can put higher buildings in a neighborhood, and then the fancier buildings come in and the property values go up and the taxes go up and the rents go up and the poor people are pushed out. So, for example, in Vancouver, we had this Woodward's development. Woodward's was an old department store, and it was redeveloped to have 536 condos, and it's 32 stories high. I think 32, 536 condos and 125 units of supportive housing and 75 units of middle-income social housing. So what happened when Woodward's went in is, before Woodward's went in, it was surrounded by SRO hotel rooms, which are like single rooms with a bathroom down the hall that were kind of the last sought before homelessness of people in Vancouver, and they were renting at the welfare shelter rate, which was $375 a month. So Woodward's opened in 2009, by 2011, all those SROs surrounding Woodward's, except for one, their rents had gone up in the $500-$600 range. And now they're almost all in that $1,100-$1,200 range. And some of them, one of them I saw on Craigslist was $1,450 the other day. So the people who used to live in those places have been pushed out, and they're now sleeping on the street, literally sleeping on the street. We have the highest homeless count we've ever had in Vancouver.
It seems that homeless rates are exploding right across, right across the country in cities like Montreal, Toronto, or this is happening all over with the low interest rates and cheap way to borrow. People are certainly making a lot of investments. I know of coworkers of mine who are just investing in the real estate and waiting to flip properties. And so homes, ironically, we have a exploding homeless rate, but we have a record number of homes that are just sitting empty. Can you talk about this, these zombie neighborhoods?
Well, what's happening in Vancouver is there are all these condos being built, and some of them are empty because of the investments. Rich people are investing in, or people that have extra money anyway, are trying to get into the market. And as a result, people that don't have investment money lurking about have no place to live. Like in Vancouver, the average rent for a one-bedroom apartment is over $2,000 a month. It's more than the entire wage of a minimum wage worker for a month, a full-time minimum wage worker. You can't have any conversation in Vancouver with anyone without them talking about how, you know, their kids are still living at home even though they're 30, or their kids have moved out to the suburbs and they can't see their grandkids. And, the housing situation here is just horrendous.
You know, your campaign is that you're going to have a revolution at City Hall. What kind of proposals are you making then that you feel would stem this kind of gentrification?
So we've called for two major things that are getting, actually setting the agenda in the campaign. I'm really pleased about the attention they're getting. One is a rent freeze. We're calling for a four-year rent freeze in Vancouver. Just no rent increase. And it's provincial, but we want to build a movement to basically prevail upon the province to bring that in. And the other one is a mansion tax. One of the reasons we have so much homelessness and such a big housing crisis is that very little social housing is being built. So with the mansion tax, we figure we could make about $175 million a year. What we do is, if your house is worth less than $5 million, you wouldn't have any increase. If it's worth between $5 and $10 million, we'd tax the amount over $5 million by an extra 1%. And if it's worth over $10 million, we'd tax the amount over $10 million by an extra 2%. So then we'd use that money for the first year to build enough modular housing units to completely end homelessness. Then the second year, we could start building so beautiful social and co-op housing like they have in Vienna, for other people who are at risk of homelessness or in bad housing situations. We'd start at the bottom of the need ladder and work our way up so that each year more and more people could be housed in beautiful social or co-op housing. And the other thing we want to do with money, and our campaign is the only one that's calling for this, is we want to start using some of that money to give land back to the three host nations, the Musqueam, Tsleil-Waututh, and Squamish, whose land was stolen from them.
You know, many years ago, Gina, I took a housing course, and I forget the exact number, but the cost of doing nothing is extremely high in policing, in human suffering, in medical. Has anyone done that in Vancouver, like calculated the cost of the status quo?
Yeah, actually, if you added up all those costs, the modular housing could pay for itself in 4 years. I think it's about $20,000 per year you save by housing a homeless person instead of keeping them on the street.
We used to have a wonderful model in Canada called the cooperative housing model. We still have it, but they haven't been investing in it for decades, I think since the late 90s. And how that works is you move into the co-op and it's based on a certain percentage of your income. So as your income increases, So does your rent. Is that the kind of model you're suggesting then?
Yeah, I live in a co-op, thank God. I've lived one for 29 years. My rent is $531 a month. Oh, I love co-ops. Yeah.
So is that what you're suggesting with this modular?
I'd actually like to get the percent of rent down from 30%, maybe to 25 or 20, because low-wage workers have a hard time making ends, you know, and people that are on fixed income have a hard time making ends meet. But, yeah, we could start at 30 and try and get it down.
And what a lot of people don't understand is many homeless people have mental health issues and need supportive housing, and different places in Europe, you mentioned Vienna, have the kind of compassionate care where they have not full-time care, but just part-time assisted living. Is that also what you'd be advocating for?
We have some supportive housing here, and a lot of the people who are in it don't like it. They say it's too institutional, too jail-like.
Okay.
So I think we need new models of providing support services to people who need them. And I know the Carnegie Action Project is working on a participatory research project to try and come up with new models. So anyway, that's something that needs to be looked at. But the current way of doing it, I don't think is working, at least not according to the people that I've talked to, which has been quite a few of them.
Let's say next Saturday or I believe not tomorrow, but the following Saturday, you're elected to city council and you're not getting cooperation because you mentioned you've been fighting vision for 12 years and these things haven't come to pass. What would be your approach to getting these things done if you didn't get any allies or people wanting to move on council?
So my plan would be to open up city council to people that are working for social and environmental justice. So like, I could make a motion that we do research to develop the mansion tax proposal and present it to the provincial government so that we would ask them to implement it or ask them to give us the power to implement it. And then we could organize delegations to come up to City Hall and support that. And there was a city council issue a while back where 300 delegations went up and it actually swayed city council, so they stopped the development proposal. So if you get lots of delegations coming, you can convince people, right? And also that way you get more media coverage and more public attention to the issue, and you can help build support. And then, you know, you can take it even further. You can organize delegations to have meetings with various provincial officials. And, you know, that's the kind of counselor I would be.
Yeah, of course, when you basically raise awareness and bring in those delegations, you can certainly bear pressure. Now, also in Vancouver, we have a terrible overdose crisis with these opioids. Do you have any strategies to deal with this terrible crisis that's taken so many people?
Yeah, it would be my first priority.
Is there any particular things?
There's three levels of government that need to be pushed. We need to build the pressure on Trudeau to make drugs clean, safe, free, and regulated. And that's the main thing. And he's got to get off the pot and do that, or people are going to keep dying. And it's going to spread across the country. And it's horrible, and we've got to stop it. So that needs to happen at the federal level. At the provincial level, we need to get good treatment options on demand. We need funding for that. So people who want to go into treatment can get it right away and can get the kind of treatment they want. Like maybe they don't want a pharmaceutical type of treatment, or maybe they want an indigenous type of treatment. They should have those options. And then the third thing that we're calling for is for the city to come up with the Aboriginal Healing and Wellness Center that they've been talking about but stalling on for the last decade or so.
You know, quite often, Jean, and I've encountered it myself in conversations, but when you talk about people who are addicts or people who are poor or hidden homeless, people don't like to think about it. People look the other way in Canada and United States, industrialized country. They believe that there's kind of a winner-take-all, and those people did it to themselves. I think this problem persists for so long because there is really a lack of compassion out there for people less fortunate than ourselves.
Well, there's a lot of discrimination happening in the world. That's what my book about poor bashing was about, one kind of that discrimination. We had a downtown east side heroine who just died recently of an overdose, Tracy Morrison. She was an amazing person. She always introduced herself and said, hi, my name is Tracy Morrison. I'm an Indigenous woman. I'm a poor woman. And I'm a drug user. And she worked, you know, nonstop for her community. You know, she did everything. She tried to get the speed limit reduced on Hastings Street. She went around educating healthcare professionals about how they should treat people who use drugs and not stigmatize and judge them. She's in the number of, she's got fancy awards from health promotion people. She could really talk to people and tell them what was up in the world of people who use drugs. And I don't know, I mean, everybody loved Tracy. She also sold Bannock on the street. So I think, you know, you just have to go from the position that everybody is a human being and everyone has contributions to make. Drug users have lots of contributions to make if we listen to them.
For me, I remember I interviewed, you'll remember, Sister Kelleher, Elizabeth Kelleher, and I interviewed her several years ago, and she was a tireless advocate for the poor in the downtown east side. And she said, everybody is blessed by the Creator and to be equal, and everybody deserves a baseline life. You know, people shouldn't have to live in such awful terms, and there should be some baseline things that are provided for. In Canada, we think, you know, healthcare is a human right, but I don't know why we just stop there. And, you know, education is a human right to grade 12, but then all of a sudden we just cut it off and no more education, no more guaranteed housing. So I don't know, in this first world country, where is the disconnect on human compassion? Because I seen a sign from the United Way and it said they had a child, it looked like an abandoned child, and they said, you know, and then next to the child they had an adult, and it says, how old do you have to be before people stop caring? So where is the disconnect, do you think, with people? Do you think people just feel that the problem is hopeless or unsolvable? I know, tough question. Because yeah. Me, it's like, what moves people to act? Do people have to come to know someone personally or have an experience? Or,
I mean, I know there are some people that are feeling that are like you're describing. But I had a meeting at my co-op the other day about the election. And we just had a bunch of people, and we sat around in a circle, and I said, what is the biggest issue for you guys? This is people who live in a nice co-op, right? And they all, every single one of them said homelessness. And they all had a story about, you know, a homeless person that they were feeding or a homeless person that they saw or whatever. They didn't like it. They wanted it ended, right?
Right.
They didn't. So I think that, I don't think people like homelessness. In general, they don't like homelessness. They would like to get rid of it. And, I think
it's definitely a moral issue.
The vast majority of people would like to get rid of it.
Yeah. What examples can we base kind of your approach on? Has this kind of thing happened before? Because, you know, there's a lot of pushback. Even when you just see the news, Justin Trudeau tried to put a marginal tax on some middle-class businesses, and there was a huge pushback. Has something like you're proposing been done before in other municipalities, or are you basing it off of another examples?
There are some places in the world where it has been done. I forget what they are right now. The provincial government raised the idea in the 90s, the NDP government, and they backed down too because of the pushback. But, you know, I'm learning a lot in this campaign. I was on a talk show, you know, and I said, well, we want a mansion tax. And they said, well, what happens if the poor mansion owners don't like that and they just move to Seattle? And what I should have said was, well, then they'd have to deal with Kishama Sawant. She's their city councilor who just passed a tax on the rich. But anyway, that's the question that's been asked for the last 40 years to justify wealth accumulation. What happens if the rich leave? Well, let them leave, you know? Why aren't we asking, why can't poorer people afford to live in the city? Why can't professional people afford to live in the city? Why can't homeless people afford to live in the city? Aren't those more important questions? So it made me think that those questions about what happens to the poor rich people, those are cliche questions that have been used for the last 40 years to justify the accumulation of wealth, to justify the type of society, the type of planet we have where the richest five men own more than the poorest 3.6 billion. And we've got to stop asking those questions, and we've got to change the questions we ask so that they're focused on the, why do we have homelessness? Why do we have hunger? You know, those kinds of questions.
We also live in a we live in a democracy. So if the majority of people aren't being served by a current system or of housing that turns homes into commodities, then what are we doing here? Are we just, is this whole place existing for, you know, 3% of the population? You know,
so there's a lot of things. Ostensibly, we live in a democracy, but there's a lot of rules that we've got in place that limit democracy. For example, in Vancouver, Vision, the ruling political party, gets hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars in donations from developers and corporations. And that skews, you know, who they vote for and what, you know, the city has the power of zoning, which is the power to give developers massive profits. So long as we have a democracy where the rich and developers can basically fund who gets elected, we don't have very much democracy. There's other things that aren't very democratic that our campaign would like to change. For example, our city is more than half tenants, but we don't have a door-to-door voter enumeration. We used to have one in the 80s, but they stopped it as a cost-saving measure, and as a result, 20,000 tenants were left off the list. You need a door-to-door enumeration because tenants move more than other people. So, or than, they move more than owners. So, you know, and we also need to have, we have 60,000 permanent residents in Vancouver who work here, live here, play here, pay taxes here, but they can't vote. And they need to be able to vote. So, and, you know, there's other things like polling places. There's, we need more on the east side. We need free transit to the polling stations, things like that, to make it easier for people who don't have a lot of money to vote. And if we did things like this, I think it would help. If we got the money out of politics, I think it would help a democracy actually be a democracy.
Exactly. We just had a by-election last weekend in Port Moody, and the voter turnout was so low. I mean, they had good candidates, but the voter turnout was so low that it just really made me sad, because a lot of people don't realize the city council level is the closest to the people. As you rightly mentioned, they are in charge of zoning, and they actually can shape how the neighborhoods look, and they're definitely, it's very important. So what would you say to the average Vancouverite who, you know, they vote provincially or federally, they don't usually show up to the polls on municipal elections like this?
Well, I would say I hope you show up on October 14th and vote for me and Diana Day of COPE for school board.
And
if you do, we'll try and shake things up, and, you know, we'll try and get a mansion tax and rent freeze. And we're also going to be working towards things like free transit and internet and getting developer money out of politics, things like that.
Well, that's amazing, because not only in
Sanctuary City, that's another thing that's really important. We need to be able to tell the police that they shouldn't report people that haven't done anything wrong to border security. That's ridiculous. And it's worse than ridiculous.
Exactly. And also, you know, if you guys get in there and shake it up, you can make an example for all the other places that have so many similar problems to Vancouver right across the country. You know, Gene, I was in a workshop and there was about 40 people and they said, I want you by yourself for 5 minutes to write down what you feel, what comes to your mind when you think of home. And, you know, not one person said, I believe home is a place that you can invest your money as a commodity and flip it and make a big bundle of money. There wasn't a single person out of 40 that thought that home is just another market tool or commodity. So yeah, I really right. wish you luck.
Yeah, thank you.
And any final thoughts before we go here? The floor is yours.
I don't know. You kind of talked me out, I think.
Okay. Well, Gene, how can people get in touch with your campaign or get more information?
You can just go to votegeneswanson.ca.
Okay. I wish you luck and thank you. I know you're busy. Thanks for spending a few moments with me this morning.
Okay. You're welcome. Bye-bye.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Visit Latin Waves Media to hear previous shows, to access resources, or support our efforts towards social change via community project engagement. Thank you and bye for now.